Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 625. I'm here in Seattle right now staring at the Space Needle with my good friend April Richardson, who will be opening. Why are you waving?
I just waved. I don't know why. It was just
you,
a reflex
you've
action.
You've done an audio podcast
I know,
of your own.
I know. I woke up 10 minutes ago. I just waved at the phone. I'm sorry.
I texted April for breakfast to see if she wanted to get breakfast this morning, and she showed up 15 minutes later. She was like, your text woke me up.
Yeah, it was my alarm.
But you went to bed at like midnight. It's like 10 a.m.
Yeah, and you're publicly shaming me?
Well, I was...
Because I enjoy my rest. I don't know. I just like sleeping. I'm a championship sleeper. It's one of my favorite activities.
How long would you have slept otherwise?
There's no answer to that question.
So you could still just be asleep.
I could wake up at like 2 p.m.
Like tomorrow.
Yeah. Like. Yes. I have absolutely slept for 24 hours before.
We're performing April's opening for me, and I'm going to be in Seattle tonight. I think there's a couple tickets left for the 10:30 show, the 8 p.m. show sold out at the Neptune Theater. And then tomorrow night in Vancouver. So, and the following weekend, Portland and Denver. So go to funcomfortabletour.com for tickets and info on that. Also, At Midnight's going back to Midnight, the nightly show where it's supposed to be.
Yeah, don't be confused by the name.
It's been weird to say At Midnight at 11:30.
Yeah, totally.
But Larry Wilmore's The Nightly Show premieres next week, so that's exciting. A new flag shall be planted in late
night.
Totally. And so it'll be Daily Show, Wilmore, and then At Midnight. What are you working on? Is there anything you want to plug or promote or talk about?
I'm really just practicing my sleeping. I'm getting really good at it. I'm going pro. I'm going to go pro soon.
You're a gold medalist sleeper. No, well, then if you go pro... Well, yeah, if you go pro, that's good. Then you can start earning the big bucks.
Why can't there be, like, an Olympic... I feel like that's discriminatory to not have professional sleeping in some capacity.
There are some Olympic events where
you
like,
seemed impressed that I could still do
sleep.
It. Yeah, totally. I mean, come on, curling. Do we need it?
So last night, April and I grabbed some dinner near, not too far from the hotel, and we watched a giant truck spend 45 minutes trying
so
to reverse into a parking structure, and he almost every time hit
like
something
into it, yeah.
Well, into a person or a car or a tree.
I felt really rude. We're having this nice dinner, and it caught my eye. So I like turned and I was like fully staring at this car or this truck for like 20 minutes, and then you were like, "Yeah." And it was it's Seattle. It's a city. We're not in it was a tiny city street. This guy was trying to back into some crazy parking deck, and also the like oncoming traffic had to sit and wait for it for like 20 minutes. And then I was just like so captivated by it that you were like, "This could be a good reality show."
It would be a good show. So we came up with the show called Backing In,
which is
basically just 22 minutes of a bunch of different truckers
like
trying to get into precarious parking spots, like,
which it could be on.
I would watch the shit.
I totally would, and like some channel already has like ice road truckers and things where it is just like a dude driving on ice, so why can't we just now have like those dudes when they're done driving their ice routes
tonight on
now
backing
you gotta back
in.
Into a tiny space.
Will this load of artichokes make it to Fort Worth? in the exact location that it is intended.
Right. In this, like, 3-foot by 3-foot square or whatever that guy was trying to back into. Yeah, it was so... And there were times, because we were sitting at the window of the restaurant, so, like, there were many times where it looked like he was just going to straight up plow right into
our table. You know, what's funny about watching someone trying to get into a parking space that they should not be trying to get into, mm-hmm. there really is, like, a dramatic arc to it. Like, there's a beginning, and how's he going to get...
Yes.
And then there's definitely a midsection, like the body of the story, and then of course the climax.
Yes.
Does he make it in? Does he hit something?
Yes.
Does he have to just drive away and give up?
Well, you were like, yeah. After like 10 minutes of it, you were like, this is where I get a new career, and I just get out of the car,
like,
throw the keys.
I was so stressed.
Yes.
I felt such an immense amount of stress for the guy.
Me too.
And there was traffic because
he had an audience.
There was traffic waiting. He stopped traffic for like 40 minutes trying to get that fucking.
And so it was like not only the annoyance of stopping traffic, but the people in traffic are watching what is supposed to be this guy's job. Like, it's like, it's your job. You're supposed to be good at it because you do it for a living. And so in front of that audience of us, the people in cars, he was like, fuck.
Well,
like,
and also that you could tell near the end, he was getting more and more erratic. Like, the pulling forward and the braking, the truck.
Yes, and like not caring if he was going up. At first, I think he was trying to avoid going up on curves and stuff. And then he was just like, I don't give a shit. Yeah, as long as I don't like plow into a building, I don't care. This has to get in here somehow.
But then ultimately, he made it in and everything turned out fine.
Yes. But as we just did a pitch for backing in, it better get picked up by some network.
Well, yeah, but we have to, this is the official record of, like...
Don't steal our idea, everybody. Now we don't have to mail it to ourselves.
No, we can just email it in podcast form.
Yes.
This episode is Ethan Hawke, which was rad. He was awesome.
What?
The look on your face is hilarious. Like, the...
Was he nice?
He was amazing.
How did he smell? I want to know. Good?
April got such, like, a wanton, sexy look on her face when I said the name Ethan Hawke.
That's not true. No, because I was like, I want to know how he smells, number one.
He smells great, all right? And he dresses great, and he's charming, and he's everything that you would want an Ethan Hawke to be.
Okay.
So that you could be his Lady Hawke.
No, I was not. He was the
by day, one of you is a wolf, and by night, one of you is a bird.
Okay, in that case, then yes.
He's promoting Predestination, which is in theaters and on demand now, so you should go see it, because Ethan Hawke does some super fun, cool movies, and he was an excellent podcast guest. All right, here's soon-to-be husband of April Richardson, Ethan Hawke.
Wow.
On this podcast. Number 625.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We all set?
I sure am.
This is happening now.
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
Am I close enough to the mic, or should I be? I should be like here too, right?
Is this your close to the mic, Cody? Is it? Or what's it?
No, I'll
see. Is this good? Recording? How about this, Cody? Is this sound okay?
Yeah. I'm here.
Oh, Cody, you produce this podcast so well.
You look so beautiful. Grace, teacher. Oh, man.
Don't cut any of that out.
Yeah.
And, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Is this a crazy press day?
No. I mean, it's a crazy press moment in my life, you know, to have the kind of shameless parade of overpraise alley that Boyhood is on, you know, and simultaneously having another movie come out.
Yeah.
You know, it
kind of... did not take several years of your life.
No, it did not. You know, it was strange, though. I did have Boyhood and Predestination were both premiered at South by Southwest, you know, this year.
Yep.
And I showed them, and it was fun to... I watched the movies one night was one and one night was the other. And when it was over, my dad said to me, "Wow, you're in two time travel movies." And and he was really right. I didn't think of it like that.
Did your dad live in Texas?
Or yeah, he lives in Dallas.
Oh, that's nice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
South by Southwest is great.
It's a fun one.
Are you going this year?
I hope so. I like going to it. I mean, it's gotten so damn huge. I don't know if it's, you know, the whole internet aspect of it or the gaming. You know, there's some part of it I don't understand that has turned the city into absolute chaos.
Yeah, the interactive, like it used to just be drunk music fans, and now it's drunk nerds and then drunk music
yeah,
fans.
Yeah, on top of it. Yeah. And movie buffs, too. So they're now all colliding in their alcoholism and you know, creating chaos.
I was at that Details Mavericks issue.
Oh, yeah.
I was in that, and we were at a dinner at the Soho House.
Yeah, I stopped by that thing for like 4.5 seconds, right?
Yeah, but I'm notoriously bad at just walking up to people and going, hey, I'm in this thing that you're in, because I always expect that person to go, I don't give a fuck, and then I slink away.
Yeah. So I always feel the same way. I was just at the AFI year-end thing where they kind of host this luncheon where their favorite 10 TV shows and their favorite 10 movies, they just kind of host a luncheon and you're there. And I mean, it's so surreal to be in there. You know, Clint Eastwood is there and Kirk Douglas is there and Steven Spielberg is there and Meryl Streep is there and Brad and Angie are sneaking in the back. And I almost couldn't talk to anybody because I felt like they would, you know, I don't know, look down from the mountaintop and the
stones. But you've been working just as long as
I guess so,
all
but you
people.
Still, there's something about them that is different, I feel.
But I can't. With the
or maybe I'm not them.
With
so.
The exception of Brad and Angelina, I would imagine that everyone probably feels that way, where it's like, oh no, everyone's different.
Brad and Angelina are pretty fabulous.
They're pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, but fabulous with all caps too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're just like, and, you know, it's like, you immediately feel diminished in some way. You know, like, oh, that's who God likes best.
And then when they leave the room, you all have like sunburns, like partial sunburns.
Yeah, on half your face.
Like a flat, yeah.
Like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, it's like a flash fry that you get. It's like circles around your eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's worth it because you're lucky to gaze upon them in real life. The film protects the mortal people from the full effect of what it would be like to be around.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
It's like staring at the Ark of the Covenant. Yeah. Like
it is a little bit like that. Your face will just melt.
Keep your eyes shut.
Close.
but like I said, you've been doing, I mean, Explorers was like 85?
30 years, man. This is my 30-year anniversary of acting in movies.
That's
it was
amazing.
A weird thing for me to realize. I turned 14 on the set of Explorers, and I turned 44 this year on the set of this you know, Chet Baker movie that I was working on. And that's when it dawned on me. I was like, wow, wait, I've been having birthdays on sets for 30 years. I should be a lot better at this job. That's what my first thought was, like, wow, man.
It is amazing when you start, because we're almost the same age, exactly the same age, but it's strange to when you start getting into numbers like 20 and 30. I've been doing a thing for 30 years.
It's strange.
Yeah, it does sound strange.
It does seem, it reminds me, there's a line in Boyhood that Patricia Arquette says, like, I just thought there'd be more. And I know what she means. You know, it's like, I don't want to be doing anything else. I mean, I love acting. It's what I want to do. But I mean, imagine if you had been doing your paper route for 30 years. I mean, I was also doing my paper route at 13. And thank God I dropped that.
Yeah. Well, Jason Robards has a very similar line in Parenthood, if you remember that movie.
Yeah.
Where he's talking to Steve Martin, who's his son in the movie. And he was like, you never cross the finish line. You never spike the ball. And it's just this moment of like, oh, that's a bummer. You know, because you keep...
But it is true too, you know.
That's I guess, but do you think it's because we have these romanticized ideals of like, well, someday I'll do this, and then that'll make my life this quality, and then those things, you know, because you're so caught up as you're doing them that you don't stop to notice them.
Yeah, I mean, I really think so. You know what's that? There's that Dylan line from Ramona, you've been tricked into thinking that the finishing end is at hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's this idea that keeps, I mean, even with, you know, the movie industry, they are always trying to trick us all into that there's the possibility of winning, you know, that there's one movie's going to be better than another, or that somehow in your life you're going to win. But the trouble is, there's always, the sun comes up the next day. And even, you know, always every year, the kind of year in movies ends with one person winning the Academy Award or something, right? And everybody else lost. Ultimately, it's kind of like the NCAA for that. I mean, eventually everybody but one person loses, right? And even that person loses the next year,
right?
You know, and it's the same way with life. I mean, inevitably, we're all going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're all going underground. We're all going back to from wherever it was we came. And there is no winning. And that's, I think, what Robards means in that movie is like, people act like, oh, my son graduated high school, I'm done parenting. You're not. You think, oh, I found love, I'm happy. Well, you're not. That's a daily thing, you know. Oh, I'm in a hit movie. I've made it. You know, no sooner have you made it than you're passé again.
Right.
And then that feels even worse because you got your chance and you blew it. You know, remember that moment? I love that moment in, what's that great movie? Stallone and De Niro are at Copland. And I love this moment. It's an amazing thing. De Niro looks at Stallone in the eyes and he says, "You had your chance and you blew it." And it was kind of a wonderful moment in cinema because there was a subconscious to that moment. You know, because Stallone, nobody, I mean, Rocky, Fist, these were unbelievable moments. And at the same time, there was a thing, because Stallone was reinventing himself at that very moment.
Yeah.
Life isn't ever blown. Stallone was great in Copland, and he was having a little comeback, right? But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of like this weird infinity circle, you know? I've been thinking a lot about the infinity circle, because that's kind of what predestination is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange dramatization of the infinity symbol of life, you know. But now I'm riffing, so
no, keep riffing.
So I can
no, keep riffing because I, you know, I don't know. It's so strange that we're talking about this because I also just had the same experience with. I was somewhere and the song "Glory Days" by Springsteen came on. It's
right.
Another one of those songs of like, well, we had our time, but now we're just getting drunk in a bar talking about our time, but it's over now. And even at that point, he was only in his 30s.
Yeah, mid-30s, I think.
And,
Jesus.
And at that point, he was still like, well, we had our chance. And, you know.
It's strange. And then that turned out to be his biggest album of all time, and now everything's in reference to that, you know.
Right. I think the important thing to remember is that
is that you and I were on the Mavericks list of
the
Details
Magazine.
That is
the most important thing that makes us slightly better than
everyone
most, else.
Yeah, it does. It makes us just a little bit.
Yeah.
At least, you know, and if not now, maybe then forever. That will last.
Yeah, normies will find, they're fine. Like normal people like Katie and Kyle and Nick and everyone else. Normal people are fine.
They're fine, but they're not Mavericks.
No, they're not. They didn't
by
get that.
By Details
they don't
Magazine.
Get that distinction. And I feel like that is an indelible mark that makes
that
us
makes
immortal.
Makes us a little bit better, yeah.
That makes us the...
And when we get to the pearly gates of heaven, you know, St. Peter will say, "You Maverick, you."
"You're going to take over here," he's going to say.
One of the things I love, sometimes when you do a period movie, you get this thing where like they'll inundate the set with period magazines and newspapers and stuff, and you read like the hot list from 1976, and it's, you know, 9 out of 10 people are people you never heard of,
or, right?
And one of them is somebody that's a total goofball now,
right.
You know, you're like, you know,
yeah.
And so it does. They're not Mavericks, obviously. I mean, ours will last. Ours will not be that way.
Right.
I guarantee you, people will remember us, and they will know that we are important.
For us and, like, Lee Majors from 1976.
Exactly.
Like, who has never gone away.
His star has never diminished, nor should it.
But I think the important thing to try to remember, and hopefully the wisdom you get when you start to get older, is that it's not, like, I think specific goals and goal achievement are really just guides for the process, right? It's really more about like what type of a person you become in as you pursue that thing. Because once you get it, then it's like, well, you got to do something else.
And I think this is I'm going to really wax the corny here. Really wax the corny. But I've been spending almost a year now talking with people about the film Boyhood, you know? And people often, you know, the architecture of the movie is original, and there's something just really unique about the attempt of telling a story over 12 years. But what is the movie about? You know, like that's one of the things I keep always like, well, what the hell is so moving about this? You know? And I keep thinking about that play, Our Town. You remember, we did it in my high school. And at the end of it, you know, it's this person dies and they get to kind of revisit. It's a little bit like It's a Wonderful Life. It's all the same thing where they get to look at their life and all of a sudden they miss eating breakfast. You know, they miss seeing their sister walk to school. And you start to realize it's just the minutiae of life that is wonderful. We think that being a maverick or being a big shot or winning this prize or having these insignificant relationships or whatever are going to be the – I mean, by relationships, I mean these moments, a wedding or – an achievement, a prom, a party, whatever it is, the Oscars, whatever these things. We think that they're going to be the good stuff. And the good stuff is like waking up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the good stuff is the stuff that's for free. It always is. And I mean, that's why I say I wax the corny, but there's that line, I forget who said, you know, the secret to life is enjoying the passing of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And to me, that's like essentially, you know, if I had to do Boyhood in a pithy little statement, you know, I mean, that really is it.
It's getting up and having the perfect eggs for breakfast, but also being a maverick. I want to make it clear that being a maverick is the most important thing.
It is definitely the most important thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I think if
I do, if it's all right to say, I envy us a little bit.
That's,
you know,
okay.
Yeah, I envy us, and I do feel a little bit sorry for
I envy the fact that you're still able to feel human emotions, because as a maverick, I'm above it all.
It's hard. It's hard for you.
Yeah, the omnipotence is really kind of a burden.
Yeah, well.
But beyond that, but I think it's important for – and I think that's why people can get so depressed so easily, because they think, oh, this thing will fix me, this thing will fix me, and then it doesn't, and then they get more depressed because that thing didn't fix them. So it's almost like, no, your time is now. Fix your shit now. But I don't think, you know, the idea of glory days of being like it's all behind you. Like, you can still, like you were sort of saying with Stallone, you know, unless you're in the ground, you can still pretty much in most cases continue to do things and create and stimulate.
It's never over. The story's never over until it is. I mean, while there's life, there's hope. There's all that. That's the Stephen Hawking line, you know? I mean, you know, and that's true for our relationships in our life that have gone bad too. You know, any of us that live any times at all, I'm always jealous. I don't really believe these people who say they have no, you know, if I could go back in time, I wouldn't change anything. I have no, and I know what they mean, maybe because it's the suffering and the things you did wrong that taught you things that leave you where I get all that. But if I could go back in time, I would fix things. But I do think that while time is happening, the possibility for healing always exists.
Sure.
I'm always amazed at my relationship with my own childhood is still changing.
How so?
As I become a parent, I see my memories with different eyes, you know? And so I'm like, I don't see it as one-dimensional as I did, you know? And I know, you know, my daughter's 16. I've been working with Eller Coltrane, who's 20, or I've been working with Sarah Snook from Predestination, who's, you know, in her mid-20s. And I'm older than them now, and I can see the eyes with which they're looking at the world. And they kind of – it takes you a while. There's just a certain orientation, and you see the world through what you're getting and not getting.
Mm-hmm.
You see the world, you know, through what you want it to be, rather than what it is, and there's a frustration, a disappointment, and a pain over that it's not what you want it to be, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the same true of our romantic relationships. You know, we have this idealized version of what lovers are supposed to look and sound like, you know? And then you get inside a relationship, and it's different than that. And is this right? Is this not right? Is this okay? Or what are the, you know, when they say relationships are work, is this what they mean? Or is this too much work? You know, none of us have, you know.
Well, because there's an idealized version, especially, you know, living in a cinematic culture, there's an idealized black or white. It's got to be, it's either this perfect thing or it's not. And that's not, and it's like, no, everything, there's a lot of elements to a thing, and there's a lot of ups and downs.
That's exactly what thank you for making my point. That was what I was trying to say, is that you're neither a good parent nor a bad parent. You're somebody who's living, and a lot of good parents make bad decisions. And, you know, there's always an opportunity to return to center, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And as long as you don't spend too much time focusing on the past or the glory days or whatever, or what you did wrong, and realize like, oh, well, I can make active choices now. Like, you don't want to live too much in the past and the future.
Exactly. You don't want to lacerate yourself, and you don't want to aggrandize yourself too mm-hmm. much, you know? I mean, I don't know.
So you said, because I'm one of these people, well, you know, there are things that I think I would go back and change. I think I probably wouldn't be, I think when I was younger, I probably wouldn't have been so hard on myself in the sense of like, oh, I suck and I'm never going to be good at anything. Like, I think I would have been nicer to myself.
Yeah.
What would you go back and do differently?
Well, I think of the thing, I interviewed Kris Kristofferson once. I was doing this profile for him, and I asked him that question, you know. I said, like, because he was talking about the first time he went, he was in the military and he stopped by the Grand Ole Opry and he was just watching. He was so nervous and all he wanted to be was a songwriter, and he just couldn't see how he could ever be in that world, you know? And I said, what advice would you say to that young man now? Like, if you could, and he had that same thought. You said, oh, I just tell myself to relax. You know that, you know, if you hold a ball underwater, it's eventually going to float up. I thought I had to do all this swimming, you know, but it eventually just, things generally go up all by themselves. And we spend a lot of time hating ourselves, and that turn makes you like be arrogant or insecure or whatever, mm-hmm. however that manifests, you know. But I would do the same thing. I would just tell myself to relax.
Did you ever go through I think I went through a dickhead period when I was young because I was scared.
I'm deeply immersed in mine right now.
Are we in it?
Yeah, I think we may. We may be, Maverick.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, what things do you take time to do throughout the day or throughout the week? Do you stop to take moments for yourself to appreciate something? Or, like, how do you keep yourself, you know, how do you keep yourself balanced?
You know, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, then, like, if I had you know, there's whole groups of people that talk about meditation. There's whole groups of people that talk about doing things for others. You know, usually getting, if you stare out at the people who you see who are octogenarians and mm-hmm. stuff that are happy and excited and really feel good about their lives, every time I look at it, in some way, they're outwardly looking, meaning that they're working towards helping other people. Mm-hmm. And there is, it's, I think that's the big transition, because when you're young, you feel like you have to fight for yourself, and you do. You know, I mean, you know, your mom and dad aren't going to take care of you forever. Nobody's going to give you your dreams. You know, nobody's going to do all that for you. And so it creates this energy of you working for yourself. But eventually, some part in the middle of the road, I think you have to start using a different map. Because if you keep using the same tools that got you through your childhood and through your young adulthood, you kind of, I think, maybe end up in the same place. I'm not really sure what the answer is, but I feel like life is asking all of us to, I mean, I think it's part of why we age and don't stay young and beautiful forever, is we're supposed to be asked to go into another stage of our life. Mm-hmm. And I think for every person it's different. But I know for my mother, for example, my mother is in her early 60s and is happier now than she's ever been. And part of that transition for her was learning to kind of like herself on her own terms. And the second that transition happened, kind of forgiving herself for the things that she was disappointed in herself about, she ended up joining the Peace Corps and she went to Romania, and she's dedicated the whole last like 15 years of her life towards gypsy rights. And the weird thing, people say, when I say that, oh, what a nice person or whatever, the funny thing is, she's not doing it to be nice. She's doing it because she likes it. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to live in Bucharest, Romania, and work with these women. They're really interesting women. And it's fun to have a reason to wake up in the morning and feel good about what you're doing and feel like, she's gotten several thousand kids in school.
Yeah.
You know, who weren't in school. And it makes you feel good about yourself, you know? And whereas the inverse of that is, of course, you know, like why people talk about the negative relationships to drug addiction and stuff is it kind of turns you inward. You keep looking inside. And the more you look inside, it's like the classic mirror thing. You just can't see anything else besides yourself. And that makes you hate yourself. It makes you look at yourself more. And it's like falling down the stairs.
You know? I've never heard that point of view before. That actually makes a lot of sense.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about it this year. You know, there's been a lot of loss this year. And for me, you know, we're nearing the year anniversary of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I've lost two of my heroes. I mean, there's only two guys of my generation who, like, really sparked the flames of jealousy and envy in me. You know, and it was River Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman. They were just major. They were able to use acting and be an artist, you know, not to be a celebrity or not. You know, they just went beyond that, and they were communicating, and that's always been my goal. And they both fell prey to, you know, nobody tripped them. They tripped themselves, you know. And if I had advice for young people Now, you know, if you could just eliminate self-destruction, life is hard enough. Just love yourself and relax. And hating yourself does not make you interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of illusion that you know, you have to be whipping yourself or you'll turn into some arrogant prick or something. And it's really not true, you know. But I've been spending a lot of time thinking about it, you know.
Well, there's a big gap between hating yourself and then thinking that you know you're perfect. You know, like
exactly.
There's a lot of room there. But it took me a long time to learn that.
I didn't. Me too. You know, and then when you do that, you vacillate a lot. You know, you go, I hate myself. Ah, I'm a genius. I was wrong to hate myself. You know, and of course, you know, I think I got to work with Sidney Lumet, you know, who was 83. And that guy kind of walked that middle path of having extreme confidence and belief in himself and being so humble and curious about other people. It was really wonderful to see somebody. You know, Tom Stoppard's the same way. I got to spend a year in a rehearsal room with him. Sometimes it's fun. You meet the older generation of people and people who haven't atrophied into bitterness and anger and what they didn't get.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you can see the profession at its finest. You know, where it's not oriented on anything superficial like beauty or trying to show off.
Right.
It's oriented in trying to
because you can't control those factors.
Not at 83, and you certainly can't. None of us can control them.
Right.
You know?
Well, how are you feeling about, you know, approaching mid 40s and then getting into, like, are you because I think about it a lot. It bothers me less than it did a couple years ago.
You know why I think? I mean, if you're like me, because we're about the same age, you know, is a couple years ago, I felt like a really old young person. I felt like I was still kind of a young guy, but I was just really old. You go to a nightclub or something, you're like, I'm just
it's
ancient.
It's loud and these people,
you know?
Are like...
And now I've crossed the board and I realize now I feel like a really young old person.
Right?
Do you know what I mean? I go hang out with all the people, but I'm the youngest one. But I can't, you know, there's certain, and in a way there's a kind of freedom to that.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be in that other room anymore.
Right.
And I like it. The air is a little bit better.
I think the important thing, like one of the lessons that something that I try to work on and something that, you know, that I would like to, that I wish I could convey to people, but everyone has to learn their own thing, is that you can't, it's rare that you can control outcomes, but you can control your perception of an outcome. Like you can control how you react, how you perceive it, what you can learn from it, because you just can't control a lot of times how chips are going
to
fall.
You can't. I'll give you a really frivolous example of that is. So I'm going to the Golden Globes tomorrow or something like that. And I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, good luck. You know, I hope you win. You know, well, it's a real dog race, you know, or something like that. And it's you can't help it. If people keep saying it to you, you start to think, well, I hope I win. You know, I don't want to lose. You know, I mean, you're a human being, right? You know, and yeah, I just have to kind of resist it in my head and kind of, I even said it to my daughter this morning. She texted me, she's like, good luck tomorrow, because you know she's in New York, and I wrote back and I said, I already won. She's like, you did? I'm like, no, not literally, damn it. I mean that I'm doing what I love and people are like patting me on the back about it. If I didn't win, who the hell did?
Right.
You know what I mean? If I'm gonna let somebody spin this into me losing, I'm not gonna.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, there's no scenario in which I lose tomorrow. I'm working with my best friend in the world on a movie that is actually kind of original that I love about family and about relationships and about exactly what we're talking about, the passage of time and how you can mature. And somebody's going to tell me I lost. You know, fuck you. You know?
I hope that's your acceptance speech if you win.
But you know, it is funny. You know, the Spierig brothers made this movie, The Predestination, that's also coming out right now. And for anybody who's seen the movie, and since I've already dropped the F-bomb, I'm going to drop
it
again.
Drop it.
Is what we really wanted for the ad line of the movie is for it to say, Predestination, go fuck yourself.
That would be. And for those who see the movie, they'll know what the hell we're talking about.
There was, yeah, there was, well, just on a tangential topic, there was a great Dudley Moore movie called Crazy People. And the whole idea was like basically this this insane asylum. They started writing ad copy, and it started like sweeping the nation. And it was because it was really honest. It was like Jaguar for men who want to get hand jobs from strange women they hardly know. You know, it's like that kind of stuff. But I think that would totally.
That's exactly who wants to buy a hand job. Jaguar. A hand job? What?
The Predestination, was it the same guy who did Daybreakers?
Yeah.
That was a fucking great movie. Well, I love Daybreakers.
These guys are cool. They're two twins. They're twin brothers. Not two twins. They're twins.
They're twins.
Even. It's not two pairs of shoes. It's a pair of shoes. Yes. Anyway, they're twins, Peter and Michael Spierig. And, you know, they look and, you know, they just talk and work and... about movies with the same kind of passion of all the people I've worked with who are the best. I mean, even if you don't, you know, it's hard to make a really good genre movie. You know, it's hard. Like if you go see those, you know, the original Assault on Precinct 13 or John Carpenter's The Thing or, you know, the really, even all those old gangster movies, you know, when some of them are really good and they survive, it's because somebody put a lot of thought into them. In a way, I kind of think it's the highest form is when you can tell a really, really entertaining story and have it be about something. Because on one level, it's kind of easy to make an art film that's about something because all it's trying to do is it be about something. You know?
Right.
But if you can make a movie – and then movies that just shamelessly entertain their – you know, I get bored with those really quickly too. You know, they just, you know, if you're just flipping cars and showing tits or,
right.
You know what I mean? That's pretty boring. But if you can make a genre movie that also has ideas at work, it's kind of it can be the most exciting thing to do. And that's what these guys are trying to do with Daybreakers and Predestination. They're making, really entertaining movies that also make you think.
Right. And do you think that's why, you've done a handful of films that are sort of like dystopian future films, mm-hmm. where like the not too distant future, it's sort of dystopic.
In the not too distant future.
Yeah,
I love those movies.
Yeah, because I guess sort of by the nature of their construction are kind of like, they're about an idea. It's a commentary on mm-hmm. this is a way that culture could go if you aren't careful.
But see, for me, for example, if somebody were to give me a script about the story of Trayvon Martin, it'd be interesting, but man, it'd be hard to make that not a TV movie, mm-hmm. you know, whereas the way that cinema works best is to take something like The Purge and say, all right, you want to talk about class warfare? You want to talk about the discrepancy of wealth? Let's imagine a futuristic society where rich people sit on their treadmill and flip channels watching while poor people kill themselves.
Right.
Let's imagine wild, and these crazy rich people don't even care that, you know, and then you watch it, but it's set in this futuristic society where you're not dictating to an audience, oh, this is bad, this is good, this is this. You just present the idea, and you make it scary and fun to go see, and oh, my God, this house is going to get broken into or not.
Right.
But underneath the thing, I mean, I'm not saying The Purge is a perfect film or I'm not saying it isn't. That's what I love about good genre movies is they have this subversive idea. You know, there's a lot. Our country is dealing with a lot of issues of class. The world is, you know. There is a large discrepancy of wealth, and a lot of the environment is being destroyed by a lot of rich people who want to consume things, and they don't want to stop. And a lot of poor people are suffering, but they're not educated, and they don't. I mean, this is the same war that's been going on throughout the history of time. And if you make some college professor speech about it, everybody falls asleep. But if you can put it in art. You know, I mean, even take something like the movie Sinister, which is a horror movie. But what I loved about Scott Derrickson is he was saying to me, like, look, this is a huge metaphor for how men oftentimes put their ambition in front of their family. He wants to write a hit book more than he wants. You know, I mean, he the ambition in him opens the door to Incubus, you mm-hmm. know, to his demons, right? Well, in this movie, it's literally a demon. Now, if you don't make that movie scary, then it's stupid.
Right.
You know what I mean? But if it's actually really scary, and then at the heart of it, It's a film about a guy betraying his own marriage with his own need for his own ego.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I think it's interesting that it is about, it's kind of the same way that, you know, like cartoon satire. It's almost cartoonish in a way that, because there's like a layer of separation, you know, that makes it exactly like what you're saying, where it's not just like right here, right now, like the not too distant future. Everything's a little.
See, I think, you know, I mean, I think like with what's going on in France right now and everything, the power of the cartoon is the power of humor. You know, and which is that humor is the great leveler of hypocrisy. You know, if you can make the right joke, you make somebody feel really foolish because you show their hypocrisy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's a really powerful medium. That's the cartoons are amazing that way.
Yeah.
Because they just, the great cartoon just makes your brain go, oh, right. That doesn't make any sense at all. You know?
This might be a corny question, and I apologize.
I'm a corny dude.
Well, okay, good. Okay, good. It was the process of making Dead Poets Society, did you feel as inspired during that process as I felt when I watched the movie and was like, oh, my God, this has opened up. Like, that movie completely, and I'm sure everyone tells you this, completely opened up, and I was the right age for it. I was like, I was like that. I was your guy. We were right there. Did it feel like you were making a movie, or did when you were making it, were you like, oh, fuck, yeah. This is all, yes.
I didn't even realize it. I mean, the funny thing is, the answer is that movie changed my life. When people say, what was your favorite movie? I have different answers on different days. But there's only one movie that changed my life, and it was Dead Poets Society. But I wasn't even aware. You know, when you're a kid, you just do things. Like, I just thought that's what making a movie was like. You know, I mean, Norman Lloyd was on the movie. He played the principal, you know, Mr. Anderson, sit down, you know, that guy. Well, he had been in the theater, in the Mercury Theater Company with Orson Welles, and we were all goofing around at lunch one day, and this old dude comes up to me, and he says, you know, you guys have no idea what's happening. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, this is one of the greatest experiences of your life, and you don't even know it, you know, because we just kind of, you know, young people just think, they're owed this or something.
Right.
Everything they get, they're owed.
Right.
You know? And I didn't realize until later, it was a couple years later, I called my agent. I was like, you know, I have this really good idea. He's like, what is it? He goes, I want to get my friends together. And like, we're just going to start, you know, every other night, we're just going to read plays. Just us. We're just going to read plays, and it'll be everybody's in the club is going to read it. They get to select a play, and they get to cast it. And so then you have to be in whatever your friends cast. And he burst out laughing. I'm like, what? Like the Dead Poets Society? And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that is what it was. And I didn't even – I mean, what I mean is like this stuff went inside me. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, carpe diem, all that stuff, you know. Oh, captain, my captain, what will your verse be? You know, all this stuff was like being funneled into my brain, but I didn't even realize it. It's been the ethos of my life, and I don't think I even knew it.
I actually haven't watched the film in a few years, and I certainly haven't watched it since Robin passed away, and I would imagine that it's probably that much more like, wow, you know, like it'd probably be it might be one of those ones that would be hard for me to get through without being like, huh, there's something in my eye. Like it would be an intense experience.
That I could not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know for a fact. I mean, you know, that movie deals with suicide. That movie deals with, you know, what that whole movie is about is, you know, finding your voice and letting your voice be heard despite the great pull of the universe towards everybody being the same and a great applause for mediocrity that happens all the time, you know. And so for me, I couldn't watch the film now. I don't know if I'll ever be able to watch it again. But I see clips from it. Sometimes they make me look at it at talk shows and things like that. And it's very strange. I mean, it's a very, very powerful movie, but at the core is a really real argument. Yeah, I mean, meaning depression is real. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, you know, life is passing, you know, food for worms, lads. Food for worms. Remember when Robin
says
that?
Yeah, of course.
You know, I remember there's – I can't remember. There's some scene where he makes us look at the photographs of the
– Oh, of all the other – the students who are old and dead.
You know,
yeah.
Remember me, you know, carpe diem. You know, it'll be strange to – You know, think about that. You know, and in one way, I don't want to let Robin's life all be owned by the passing of it. You know, so much brilliant work, so much happiness he brought to people.
Yeah.
So much. I mean, I think that's why people were so devastated. He made us all so happy. It was so hard to imagine that he didn't do that for himself.
Right. You know? Right. That was. I mean, we've talked about that too. That it was such a crime that he wasn't able to connect with that.
Ah, so frustrating.
I mean, even if you were able to make one person happy in your life, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But to make millions and millions of people happy for 40 years and still not be able to feel it. Yeah.
But you know, I saw that on this, you know, anybody who worked with him, you know, for every high there's a low, you know, all that expending of all that energy, all that going out,
yeah,
has a cost, you know.
Well, and it's also, I mean, you know, I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like a lot of performing can be, in a way, sort of, you know, distracting yourself and running away from shit that you really don't want to face or deal with, you know, like putting yourselves in other
Absolutely.
People's lives and
Absolutely.
Other without
and
having
don't forget, you know, when there's any, just to, on Robin, is if there was any criticism to his work when he was alive, you know, the criticism always revolved around his tendency towards being incredibly sentimental. There was a real hurt there, you know, a lot of times in his work, you know, he was quick to cry. You know, but people didn't really want him to do that. You know, and they criticized, you know, there was so much heart in him. And I think a lot of our comedians are that way. Buster Keaton, you know, these guys have this just immense empathy and matched with intelligence. You know, you can't be that funny without being really smart, right? You know, and so, but with that incredible intelligence and that kind of sensitivity doesn't mean you have the necessary toughness
right.
to keep looking at all those truths.
Right. Well, the chatter, the internal chatter can be overwhelming.
Right. It must have been for him. Must have been.
Do you have that at all? Do you have, like, you know, are you able to shut your brain off?
With vast amounts of drugs and alcohol. With self-medication, yes. You know, I don't know. That's a good question because I'm a pretty restless person, you know, when you just mentioned the thing about people running away from things. You know, I work pretty nonstop, and I sometimes have to wonder what is making me so restless, mm-hmm. you know? But hopefully it's love.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I love what I do, you know? And it's nothing feels better than sitting inside a movie theater and listening to people laugh or watching people respond to Boyhood the way they do, or making people feel, you know, I mean, I think that's really all of us. We just hate apathy. We hate sleepwalking through our lives. This great line at the end of Predestination is this movie is this huge riddle. You know, it's an infinity symbol. It's an enigma inside an enigma. It doesn't make any sense. And at the very end, the character, I don't want to ruin it. It won't ruin it because the movie's totally, it's a movie you need to, if you like it, you want to see it three times anyway, so it doesn't matter. There's no spoiling anything. He looks right in the camera and says, I know who I am, but do you know who all you zombies, but I don't know who all you zombies are. You know, and it's right out of Heinlein's story, and it's a reaching out on the page that Heinlein's doing of saying, hey, are you asleep? Are you listening? You know, this is your life, and it's happening right now, and don't be a zombie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ask yourself some questions, think a little bit. You know, I mean, that's what Heinlein was saying. And here it's, you know, was that story written in the 50s? And the question still resonates. It's still like a Zen cone. It pings out, you know?
It's kind of the same. There's kind of that theme in Gattaca, too.
Sure is. I didn't save anything for the swim back, you know? I mean, there's, you know, remember that moment?
Yeah.
You want to know how I did it? And it's all this stuff is happening. You know that great line, I forget who said it, you know, the creation didn't happen. It's happening, you know. So
you feel like ultimately at and something just hit me, in, which is you said your mom was in her early 60s, so she was a young mom.
She's 18 when I was born, yeah. I often say she was 17. She always gets mad at me. I was 18. I'm like, Mom, you still sound white trash. Okay? It's like, you know. Then she, like, it's, she's like, hey, you know, it's still a teen pregnancy, darling. Yeah. And you were 17 when you got pregnant, so don't tell me. You know. I know where I am. I know where I come from.
Did you grow up? Is that where you're from? Are you from Texas?
Austin, Texas. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. When did you move? Did you go to New York first or L.A. first?
I went. I went to New York when I graduated high school, but my mom and I traveled around. I mean, I went to, I think, 10 different schools in my 12 years of education, you know? So, you know, I was Atlanta, Brooklyn, Vermont, Connecticut, a bunch of different places. I graduated high school in New Jersey.
Okay. And who, I'm just curious, who are your all-time favorite authors and who are you, because I know you're a huge literary guy from what I understand.
Well, not as much as I, one thing that my kids have done is they've just annihilated, that and my bad eyesight has annihilated my reading recently, but I hope to get it back. I'm reading a Jim Thompson novel right now and I forgot how much I love him, you know, and I love Steinbeck and Tolstoy. You know, my real favorites are not necessarily the brilliant Thomas Pynchons of the world or the – I love the people like James Baldwin who can give you a really profound story that's really easy to read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the genius behind Tolstoy is that, you know, you don't need a high school education to read Anna Karenina. I mean, he's got these Russian names in it, make it a little hard. But he was very he worked very hard to find the right word that just told the story.
Yeah.
And he was very human. I mean, you know, there's a – Rick never talks about it because Rick is not nearly as pretentious as I am. But, you know, the beating heart of boyhood is Tolstoy's childhood, boyhood, and youth, you know, about his book on childhood. And there is something Tolstoyan about boyhood in its absolute simplicity. You know, there's just nothing fabulous happens in the movie. It's absolutely ordinary. And that's the way Anna Karenina feels to me. You know, it's the way Grapes of Wrath, really simple. There's not these huge paragraphs of mind-blowing genius writing. It's just really honest and insightful into the way people think, you know. And so that's my favorite kind of writing. That, and I do love science fiction too. You know, I mean, and you take Tolkien, for example. Tolkien or, you know, what's his name? The brilliant dude who wrote Game of Thrones.
Oh, George R. R. Martin.
He's not, they're not so fabulous writers. You know, C.S. Lewis, they write very clearly. You know, it's pretty easy to read. You know, you can get it at 13 or 14, and then it means even more to you at 65, you know. My dad just reread the Tolkien again. He wrote me, he's like, wow, man, that guy was smart. I mean, it's great writing that is very approachable. That's my favorite stuff.
There, you're talking about Boyhood. You're like, yeah, you know, like there aren't these giant, there were so many moments in that movie where I was like, it's like there'd be a long shot of him driving in the car and be like, there's going to be a car accident. I kept thinking like something really horrible was going to happen. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh no, it's just life.
But you know, that's where the genius of the movie lives, because you know, that's how we feel about our own lives. Which so people often say, like, why do you enjoy vacation so much more when you look back at the pictures than when you're on it, you know? And it's because in our daily life, we're worried something bad is going to happen. You know, most of the day, we're always kind of, you know, I mean, it's our human preservation instinct. We don't want to fall down. We're worried we're going to get a car wreck. We're worried oh, wait, am I getting a cold? You know, it's like we're always worried. Does she like me? Maybe she doesn't love me anymore. You know, like, all that stuff is in. And when we can look at the past and go, oh, that did work out. She did like me. Prom went great, you know.
Are you better with relations? Do you think you feel more in control or better of your in you know, interpersonal relationships now? Like, do you feel like, oh, I'm kind of getting it now?
I'm better than I was, I guess. But, I mean, I can hear my daughter, like, just snickering if I were to say, you're good at it? Jeez, Dad, you're terrible. You know, whenever you
the trick, I think, to having a decent relationship, if there was one, is a listening and being open. So as soon as you think you're got it all on, you're already losing. You know, because as soon as you think you know what's happening, you're probably not listening.
Well, and here's a trick too. And weirdly, doing podcasts has helped me in my interpersonal relationships. Is just like you said, listen to someone, and the way that you know that you're doing that is if you're thinking about what you want to say, so you can say it as soon as they're done talking. Mm-hmm. You're not listening to the
exactly.
other person.
That's it'll be my. This is my. I got to tell you my favorite acting advice I ever got. Right, which is, you know, this acting teacher was saying was the student comes up to him and goes, you know, I know the secret to acting is really, really listening, but just how can I be a better listener? And this acting teacher said to this kid, all right, tell me what you had for breakfast. Okay, so you tell me what you had for breakfast. I couldn't give a shit. that's what somebody's really thinking. But yeah, so if you're really thinking about what you're gonna say next, you're probably not listening.
Well, we're almost like this is it. We are almost out of time with you. But I do want to pitch you one idea, which is that we go in, we take the movie Explorers. And sink $100 million into the last 10 minutes of the film and put in like crazy fucked up alien effects. Yeah. So when you guys go into space, just like the most like, insane like Guillermo del Toro
like yeah, style. Computer generated amazing yeah. crap.
That, and I'm insane also practical
like Christopher
effects,
Nolan
CG.
Do the last 10 minutes, you know? Yeah.
That would be
cool.
Okay, good. Well, yeah. As long as you're on board with it, yeah. I can at least pretend
if I can
that
just
it might
do
happen.
The voiceover. So my voice isn't like this, but we have our own spaceship.
Well, it was good to see you, man. Thank you so much for being here. And Predestination. When is Predestination?
Yesterday.
It came out yesterday.
It's okay. On VOD now, and it's out in theaters and on VOD right now.
Excellent. Well, I hope you're doing well in general, and I hope we get to chat again soon. And thanks
so
for being
far,
here,
so
man.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
You maverick, you.
You maverick. Let's go lead our maverick life. Mm-hmm.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Gen Z high school girls have gone through a lot. So what could and did send a shockwave through a group of 50 of them competing in one of the nation's biggest scholarship competitions? I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I'm going to take you behind the scenes of the Distinguished Young Women Competition. I was Nevada's competitor 20 years ago, but this time, a Supreme Court decision catapults all 50 girls into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. These girls, who have spent months fighting to make it to nationals, are faced with a tough decision. Do they speak up for their political beliefs, or do they stay focused on winning the money?
I think it's going to get ugly.
Follow the competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of the competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.